Morning. This morning we're going to be reading out of the book of 1 Kings, which I bet hasn't been preached here in a little while. We're going to read 1 Kings 19, 1 through 18. Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done and how he had killed all the prophets with the sword. Then Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah saying, "So may the gods do to me and more also, if I do not make your life like the life of one of them by this time tomorrow." Then he was afraid, and he got up and fled for his life and came to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah. He left his servant there. But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a solitary broom tree. He asked that he might die. "It's enough. Now, O Lord, take away my life, for I'm no better than my ancestors." Then he lay down under the broom tree and fell asleep. Suddenly an angel touched him and said to him, "Get up and eat." He looked, and there at his head was a cake baked on hot stones and a jar of water. He ate and drank and lay down again. The angel of the Lord came a second time, touched him and said, "Get up and eat, otherwise the journey will be too much for you." He got up and ate and drank, and then he went in the strength of that food 40 days and 40 nights to Horeb, the mount of God. At that place he came to a cave and spent the night there. Then the word of the Lord came to him, saying, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" He answered, "I've been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the Israelites have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. I alone am left, and they are seeking my life to take it away." God said, "Go out and stand on the mountain before the Lord, for the Lord is about to pass by." Now there was a great wind, so strong that it was splitting mountains and breaking rocks in pieces before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake. But the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire. But the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, a sound of sheer silence. When Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his mantle and went out and stood at the entrance of the cave. Then there came a voice to him that said, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" He answered, "I've been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the Israelites have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. I alone am left, and they're seeking my life to take it away." Then the Lord said to him, "Go, return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus. When you arrive, you shall anoint Hazael as king over Aram. Also you shall anoint Jehu, son of Nimshi, as king over Israel. And you shall anoint Elisha, son of Shaphat of Abel-Meholah, as prophet in your place. Whoever escapes from the sword of Hazael, Jehu will kill. And whoever escapes from the sword of Jehu, Elisha shall kill. Yet I will leave 7,000 in Israel, all the knees that have not bowed to Baal, and every mouth that has not kissed him." So this morning's scripture passage is a Quaker favorite. If you spent any time with Quakers, you probably heard someone talking about the still small voice of God. And that's the King James. And the King James says still small voice. I'm actually kind of confused why it says the sound of sheer silence in the RSV. Because I went and looked at the Hebrew. It says a small, still voice. That's in the Hebrew. So I don't know how they translate it that way. But we love this. We love this passage. We always zoom right into that part. Like, we might talk about the earthquake and fire and the wind, but we really want to talk about the still small voice. And we certainly don't talk a lot about all the other stuff here. Because we really like this metaphor and we want to zoom in on it. The still small voice of God that speaks in the life of every human being. It's central to the Quaker faith. Our faith identifies the still small voice as being the resurrected Jesus. The Quaker tradition of Christianity teaches us that all of our discernment, all of our decisions, all the things that we do and think as individuals and as community should be rooted in the still small voice, the light of Jesus within us and among us. So given how important this metaphor is to us as Quakers, I think it's worth our time to dig into the context of this metaphor of the still small voice. What led the Hebrew prophet Elijah into his famous encounter with the voice of God? So prior to our reading this morning, Elijah's just gone through a huge amount of conflict. He's literally been at battle with King Ahab and his wife Jezebel, who are supporting the idolatrous Baal worship of the wider region. Now, Baal is a foreign god, one of many gods, and a very popular god in the region. And Jezebel, who gets a very bad name, Jezebel is not a good name these days, it's a bad name. And there's a reason in the Old Testament, because she's a foreign princess, she's from Phoenicia, and she's brought her own religion with her. And she's a major patron of the Baal cult. And she's convinced the king, Ahab, to join her in this. And together they've set up a temple to Baal at Mount Carmel in Samaria, which, just as a very tangential side note, if you remember Jesus with the woman at the well in Samaria, her people still worship at Mount Carmel. So this is like an ancient religious division. Okay, so in the midst of Ahab's disastrous kingship, he's a bad king in a succession of bad kings. Elijah has been a servant of the Lord. He's serving as God's agent and God's mouthpiece to Ahab and the ruling classes of Israel. He's been challenging the intrusion of false religion into his society. God has given him authority to declare a drought for 3 years because of Ahab's actions. The drought is so severe that Elijah would have died if it weren't for God's miraculous intervention and the hospitality of a poor widow at Zarephath. So it's been 3 years, and after 3 years of drought and extreme famine, Elijah knows that it's time to end the drought. And to mark this occasion, he shows up at Mount Carmel in Samaria, where Ahab and Jezebel have set up this temple to Baal. And Elijah says that he's the only prophet left of God. Turns out that maybe that's not quite true, because there are 100 prophets hidden away in caves, but he says he's the only prophet left. And he challenges the 450 prophets of Baal to a contest. He says, look, each of us are going to call on the name of our God, and whichever God sends fire from heaven to consume our sacrifice, that's the real God. So the priests of Baal spend all morning calling on the name of their God. And Baal doesn't answer, not a peep out of Baal. It's actually one of the funnier scenes in the Bible, in my opinion, because Elijah's like, isn't this a God? Maybe he's taking a nap. Maybe he's gone on a journey. Maybe he's meditating. Maybe he should yell louder. But when Elijah, you know, predictably, right, this is the Bible. When Elijah calls on the name of the Lord, fire comes from heaven immediately, and the bull that he sacrificed and the wood, and even Elijah poured a bunch of water on the sacrifice, and all of it's consumed immediately by the fire. So not ambiguous. And seeing the power of God, all the people are convinced. They weren't willing to decide before, but they're convinced. And what's the next step? Obviously, Elijah orders them to slaughter all 450 of them. So they kill all those people, because the penalty for being a false prophet is death. And once all those prophets have been killed, God sends a miraculous thunderstorm to end the drought. And that's everything that's happened up to where we read from the Bible today. That's where our passage begins. And so Ahab, I guess, was there when all this went down with the priests of Baal. And he runs back home to tell Jezebel what happened, which I find super interesting. He didn't do anything right there. He went back to talk and confer. And Jezebel is very upset and lets Elijah know that she sends Elijah a messenger saying, I'm going to kill you, which is super weird to me, because like, if you can send a messenger, why don't you send a hitman, right? Anyway, maybe it was, she thought it was colder to let him know beforehand. So Elijah runs, right? He's overcome by fear of Jezebel and her murderous threats. Elijah's terrified. After all that's happened, after God sent his power from heaven and confirmed his might, Elijah runs. He runs away into the wilderness again, where God sends a ministering angel to feed him so that he won't be too weak to make the journey. And so the journey is, it turns out, to Mount Horeb, which is the same mountain where God once spoke to Moses and gave the law and the commandments. So when Elijah, it takes 4 days and 40 nights without any additional food beyond the food the angel gave him. There might be some reference to this in the New Testament with Jesus fasting for 40 days and 40 nights in the wilderness. This is a recurring theme. But when he gets to Horeb, Elijah goes and hides himself in a cave and spends the night. And that's when Elijah hears the voice of God. And what does God say to him? What are you doing here, Elijah? That's the inflection of voice that I hear. And Elijah says, I've been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the Israelites have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. I alone am left, and they are seeking my life to take it away. So Elijah's kind of a downer, right? I don't hear him mention the fire from heaven. That was super cool. I don't hear him mention the thunderstorm. After the 3 years of drought that Elijah's prophecy instituted through the power of God, didn't hear anything about that. That was pretty cool. I mean, at least, you know, for God's glory. There's no memory of the provision from the angel that fed him on his way and allowed him to arrive while fasting for 40 days. No mention that, I mean, Elijah's God beat Baal's prophet's God, right? Like, he was able to do his ministry, and a pretty bloody one at that, and he wasn't hurt, right? So I'm baffled at Elijah's lack of perspective. It's like, oh, it's so terrible. Oh, everything was turned away, and I'm alone. It's like, God has done so much stuff really recently. That's amazing. Okay, so Elijah's complaining, and God just says, go out and stand on the mountain in the presence of the Lord, for the Lord is about to pass by. And so standing there, Elijah gets the moment of glory. Now this, right, we don't talk about any of this other stuff normally, but here's the part where Quaker's like, okay, but this is the thing. This is it. Now there was a great wind so strong that it was splitting mountains and breaking rocks in pieces before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, a sound of sheer silence. When Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his mantle and went out and stood at the entrance of the cave. Okay. So God speaks to Elijah and says, what are you doing here? Elijah's like, I have some complaints. God has him go stand out. He hears the voice of God again after all these manifestations of God's power. And then he goes back to the cave, and God says again, what are you doing here, Elijah? And Elijah just says the exact same thing, word for word. I told Faith, I feel like this whole passage is a nothing burger. Nothing really happens here. It's a very boring conversation and a confusing one. Because Elijah's just encountered the presence of the Lord on the mountain of God where Moses himself received the Ten Commandments. And after all this, his mindset hasn't changed at all. He's still afraid and self-pitying. So the encounter with God winds down at this point. It's still not clear why Elijah has come to Mount Horeb at all. He gives no compelling answer to God's query. But the conversation moves on. God tells Elijah to return the way he came and continue the work of the Lord. Anoint a new king over Aram and another one over Israel. And God tells Elijah to anoint a successor, Elisha, to continue his work. And that's what Elijah does. He goes back the way he came. He returns to the wilderness of Damascus and encounters Elisha, whom he calls his disciple and successor. And Elijah continues serving as God's prophet for some time afterward. So, as Tolkien said, the road goes ever on, the work continues. I'm left pondering, what does this story even mean? Why did Elijah travel to the Mount of God and take refuge in that cave? Why was he so afraid of Jezebel when God had made it really clear God could take care of his own? What was the purpose of this repetitive conversation with God? No law was given, as to Moses. Just a simple question asked repeatedly. What in the world are you doing here, Elijah? There was a wind and an earthquake and a fire and a still small voice in the midst of it all. But at the end, everything was just like it was before. Elijah had been an instrument of God's visible power, famine, fire, mass violence. And in the following pages, we see that he'll be the instrument of even more work that God has to do. So Elijah was fully engaged in God's work, and work that took him to very dark and dangerous places. So what was the deal with this thing at Mount Horeb? Because God's query doesn't feel rhetorical. The voice is there when he arrived, and it's thereafter all the chaos and revelation asking him, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And I think the word of the Lord does this morning is, "What are we doing here?" Right? Do we imagine that here in this quiet retreat, in our sanctuary of cedar, that God will tell us something different from what he's been trying to tell us all week? What are we doing here? I'm reminded how Jesus asked the blind man Bartimaeus in the Gospel of Mark, when Bartimaeus came to him for the restoration of his sight because he was blind, Jesus didn't make any assumptions, and he said, "What do you want me to do for you?" And it makes me wonder whether, if at any point Elijah recognized his own blindness and the fear that he had in the face of human threats, when God was so clearly with him and so powerful. And I wonder about us. Do we recognize our own blindness, our need to have our sight restored so that we can see the world the way that God sees it? What do you want me to do for you? Why are you here, Elijah? The world isn't what we expected it to be. It's full of darkness and evil and pain. The winds and the earthquakes and the fires of this chaotic age threaten to throw us off our foundation, to distract us from the still small voice of God that's speaking to us in every moment. And we're tempted to think that the point of the Christian life is to seek that quiet moment, that tender voice that will whisper to us and tell us that everything is okay. But what Elijah discovered, I hope, and countless generations of other faithful people since Elijah's day have discovered, is that this still small voice is calling us into hard places, into loud places, into chaotic places. He's sending us back into the world with all its terror and violence. He's sending us as men and women of God who can get directly involved in the suffering of the world and speak God's word into it, even when we don't want to go, even when it's frightening and uncertain. The still small voice is there, always available, to remind us that we belong to Christ and Christ belongs to God. The power of God, the majesty of God, is at work within us to bless the world and bring about God's kingdom. Elijah's experience is confirmed by the experience of the early Quakers, who found that, in the words of William Penn, true godliness doesn't turn men out of the world, but enables them to live better in it and excites their endeavors to mend it. And that's the part of the quote, if you've ever heard this quote before, that's part of the quote we always hear. But there's a little bit more. Penn also wrote, "Christians should keep the helm and guide the vessel to its port, not meanly steal out at the stern of the world and leave those who are in it without a pilot to be driven by the fury of evil times upon the rock or sand of ruin." And I thought that second part was relevant, because when Elijah made his way to the mountain of God, I think he was tempted to steal out at the stern of the world. I mean, he asked God to let him die. He wanted out. He wanted to be done. But that's not why God called Elijah to be done, to get out. And that's not why he's called us. God has chosen us so that we, being strengthened by his inward power, will take the risks of full engagement with the world, encountering the world on its own terms, so that through our faithful presence, it might one day be reconciled to God. So are we ready for that? Will we be faithful? Will we avail ourselves of the time of inward listening and hearing and receiving the still small voice of God that we do here on Sunday morning? Will we avail ourselves of this time to encourage us and strengthen us and direct us in our course back out into the world that so desperately needs the light of God? I really hate conclusions of anything I write. Conclusions are really hard. And so I was sort of sitting with this, like, how do I even end this? And I find this sermon difficult to land properly, because I feel like there's a lot of tension still here in this story. Because on the one hand, we're called to listen and attend to the voice of God. And at the same time, we're encouraged to be faithful to the word that we've already heard, right? We have to listen, but once we've heard, we have to be faithful to what we heard. We have to obey. And sometimes the truth is that we already know enough. We've heard what the still small voice wants to tell us. And all our prayers and supplications can be a distraction from the hard work of acting on the message that we've been given. I'm reminded of a famous quote from the eclectic philosopher Alan Watts, who I never thought I would quote in a sermon, ever, but he's got a good line. He said one time, "If you get the message, hang up the phone." If you get the message, hang up the phone. And so a question for us this morning is, have we gotten the message? There's a time for contemplation and discernment. There's also a time for action. What is the action that God's calling us to? What's the message that God has revealed in us that we must be faithful to? What are those things that we do know? And what will it take for us to finally stop deceiving ourselves, imagining that we just need one more talk with Jesus or maybe one more good book to read before we can do the work and lead the lives that he's commanded us?